Philadelphia AA soon attracted the attention of three noted Philadelphia physicians, Doctors A. Weiss Hammer, C. Dudley Saul, and John F. Stopher, the latter of the Philadelphia General Hospital. The outcome of this interest was the best of hospital care for alcoholics and the opening of a clinic. And it was Dr. Hammer's friendship with Mr. Curtis Bach, owner of the Saturday Evening Post, that led to the publication in 1941 of Jack Alexander's article. These friends could hardly have done more for us. Fitz, living near Washington, D.C., had no such breaks. Near failure dogged his efforts for years, but he finally planted seed there that bore fruit, and before his death in 1943, he saw that seed flower. His sister Agnes rejoiced with him. She had loaned him and me $1,000 from her modest resources when, after the AA book fiasco in 1939, the future had looked the darkest. To her, I send our everlasting thanks. The year 1939 saw the arrival among us of still another unforgettable character, a woman alcoholic known to so many of us as Marty. At Blythewood Sanitarium in Greenwich, Connecticut, she had been a patient of Dr. Harry Thibault's, and he had handed her a pre-publication manuscript copy of the AA book. The first reading made her rebellious, but the second convinced her. Presently, she came to a meeting held in our living room at 182 Clinton Street, and from there she returned to Blythewood carrying this classic message to a fellow patient in the sanitarium. "Granny, we aren't alone anymore." Marty pioneered a group in Greenwich so early in 1939 that some folks now think this one should carry the rating of AA's group number 3. Backed by Dr. Harry and Mrs. Wiley, owner of Blythewood, the first meetings were held on the sanitarium's grounds. Marty was one of the first women to try AA, and she became in later years among the most active workers we have, as well as a pioneer in the field of education and rehabilitation for alcoholics. Today, she holds the longest sobriety record in AA for her sex. There had been another earlier woman pioneer, Florence R., who had come among us in 1937. Her story was printed in the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. With great valor, she had tried to help Fitz at Washington, but she became involved in the early wave of failure there and died of alcoholism. Old-time Midwesterners at the convention could remember that while all this was going on in Akron and New York, certain candles were being lighted in Cleveland, which presently sent up a flame that could be seen countrywide. A few older Clevelanders remembered how some of them had gone to the Akron meetings, then held in the home of Oxford groupers T. Henry and Clarice Williams. There, they had met Dr. Bob and Ann, and had looked with wonder upon alcoholics who had stayed sober 1, 2, and 3 years. They had met and listened to Henrietta Seiberling, the non-alcoholic, who had brought Dr. Bob and me together in her house 3 years previously, one who had understood deeply and cared enough, and who was already seen as one of the strongest links in the chain of events that Providence was unfolding. On other evenings, Clevelanders had gone to Dr. Bob's Akron home, sitting with him and Ann over cups of coffee at their kitchen table. Eagerly, they had absorbed knowledge of their problem and its solution, and had breathed deeply of the remarkable spiritual atmosphere of the place. They became friends with old Bill D., AA number 3. At other times, Dr. Bob had taken them to St. Thomas Hospital, where they met Sister Ignatia, saw her at work, and in their turn, talked to the newcomers on the beds. Returning to Cleveland, they began to dig up their own prospects and got to know for the first time the pains, the joys, and the benefits of AA's 12 steps. Clarence S. and his wife Dorothy were among the earliest contingent to come from Cleveland to the Akron meeting. By the early summer of 1939, a group had commenced to form around them in Cleveland, where by fall they could count a score or more of promising recoveries. At this point, the Cleveland Plain Dealer ran a series of pieces that ushered in a new period for Alcoholics Anonymous, the era of mass production of sobriety. Elric B. Davis, a feature writer of deep understanding, was the author of a series of articles that were printed in the middle of the Plain Dealer's editorial page, and these were accompanied every 2 or 3 days by red-hot blasts from the editors themselves. In effect, the Plain Dealer was saying, Alcoholics Anonymous is good, and it works. Come and get it. The newspaper switchboard was deluged. Day and night, the calls were relayed to Clarence and Dorothy, and from them to members of their little group. Earlier in the year, through the good offices of Nurse Edna McDee and the Reverend Kitterer, administrator of Deaconess Hospital, an AA entry was made into this institution. But this one hospital could not begin to cope with the situation that now confronted Cleveland. For weeks and weeks, AAs ran about in desperate haste to make 12-step calls on the swelling list of prospects. Great numbers of these had to be tossed into other Cleveland hospitals, such as Post Shaker, East Cleveland Clinic, and several more. How the bills were paid, nobody ever quite knew. Sparked by Clarence and Dorothy, clergymen and doctors began to give great help. Father Nagel and Sister Victorine at St. Vincent's Charity Hospital were meeting the new tide with love and understanding, as was Sister Merced at St. John's. Dr. Dilworth Lupton, the noted Protestant clergyman, preached and wrote warmly about us. This fine gentleman had once tried to sober up Clarence, and when he saw AA do the job, he was astonished. He published a pamphlet widely used in Cleveland entitled Mr. X and Alcoholics Anonymous. Mr. X, of course, was Clarence. It was soon evident that a scheme of personal sponsorship would have to be devised for the new people. Each prospect was assigned an older AA who visited him at his home or in the hospital, instructed him on AA principles, and conducted him to his first meeting. But in the face of many hundreds of pleas for help, the supply of elders could not possibly match the demand. Brand new AAs, sober only a month or even a week, had to sponsor alcoholics still drying up in the hospitals. Homes were thrown open for meetings. The first Cleveland meeting started in June 1939 at the home of Abby G. and his wife Grace. It was composed of Abby and about a dozen others who had been making the journey to Akron to meet at the Williams home. But Abby's group presently ran out of space, so one segment began to meet in the home of Cleveland's financier, Mr. T.E. Borton, at his generous invitation. Another part of the group found quarters in a hall in the Lakewood section of Cleveland and became known as the Orchard Grove Group. And still a third offshoot of Abby's meeting went under the name of the Lee Road Group. These multiplying and bulging meetings continued to run short of home space, and they fanned out into small halls and church basements. Luckily, the AA book had come off the press 6 months before, and some pamphlets were also available. These were the guides and time savers that probably kept the hectic situation from confusion and anarchy. We old-timers in New York and Akron had regarded this fantastic phenomenon with deep misgivings. Had it not taken us 4 whole years, littered with countless failures, to produce even 100 good recoveries? Yet there in Cleveland, we saw about 20 members, not very experienced themselves, suddenly confronted by hundreds of newcomers as a result of the Plain Dealer articles. How could they possibly manage? We did not know. But a year later, we did know, for by then, Cleveland had about 30 groups and several hundred members. Growing pains and group problems had been terrifying, but no amount of squabbling could dampen the mass demand for sobriety. Yes, Cleveland's results were of the best. Their results were, in fact, so good, and AA's membership elsewhere was so small, that many a Clevelander really thought AA had started there in the first place. The Cleveland pioneers had proved 3 essential things. The value of personal sponsorship, the worth of the AA book in indoctrinating newcomers, and finally the tremendous fact that AA, when the word really got around, could now soundly grow to great size. Many of the essentials of AA, as we now understand them, were to be found already in the pioneering groups in Akron, New York, and Cleveland as early as 1939. But there remained much more to be done, and lots of questions to be answered. Would many AAs, for example, moving out of the old original groups, be successful in new towns and cities? In those days, the first few of our early AA travelers, the forerunners of thousands, were on the move. We had watched one named Earl T. As soundly indoctrinated by Dr. Bob and the Akronites, he returned home to Chicago in 1937. With much concern, we had followed his constant but fruitless efforts to start a group there, a struggle that lasted 2 whole years, despite the help of Dick R., his first convert, and Ken A., who had migrated from the Akron group in 1938. Then, in mid-1939, 2 Chicago doctors came upon the scene. Earl's friend, Dr. Dan Kraske, handed him 2 floundering patients. One of them, Sadie, began to stay dry. A little while later, a Dr. Brown of Evanston exposed several patients to Earl. Among them were Sylvia, Luke, and Sam, and his wife, T., all of whom have remained sober to this day. Sylvia, however, got off to a slow start. In desperation, she visited Akron and Cleveland, the founding centers in Ohio. Here she was exposed to Henrietta and Dr. Bob, and was worked over by Clarence and Dorothy, the Cleveland elders. Still, she drank on. She returned to her home in Chicago, where, for reasons best known to herself and God, she suddenly got sober and stayed that way. Chicago now had the solid nucleus from which its coming great growth could issue. Continually encouraged by Dr. Brown, vastly helped by Sylvia's non-alcoholic personal secretary, Grace Coltis, and cheered on by Earl's wife, Katie, the Chicagoans started to search for still more prospects. Meetings soon began, both in Earl's home and in Sylvia's. As AA in Chicago slowly grew and prospered, Grace was continually at the business end of Sylvia's phone, and she became the group's first secretary. When the Saturday Evening Post article appeared in 1941, the traffic became very heavy. Sylvia's place became a sort of Chicago Grand Central, and things were just about as rugged with Earl and Katie. Something had to be done. So they rented a one-room office in the Loop, and Secretary Grace was installed there to direct the stream of applicants for 12-step attention, hospitalization, or other help. This was AA's first organized local service center, the forerunner of the many intergroup associations we maintain in large cities nowadays. Many an AA group within a several hundred mile radius of Chicago can trace its origin to the work of that center, notable early ones being Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. Meanwhile, Katie realized that many AA families needed the program as much as their alcoholics did, and she vigorously carried on the precedent already set by Ann and Lois, who in their homes, in their AA travels with Dr. Bob and myself, and even upstairs in New York's old 24th Street Club, had urged AA's 12 steps upon non-alcoholic wives and husbands as a way of restoring family life to normal. No one knows exactly when the first family group as such started. One of the largest, most vigorous, and best accepted of the early family centers developed in Toronto, Canada. There they wrought so well that many AA groups in the area customarily invite family group speakers to their meetings. By 1950, the Toronto family group had created such a wide and deep impression that their speakers were featured at the Cleveland International AA Convention of that year. And what was true of Toronto was equally true of Long Beach, California, and Richmond, Virginia. Indeed, some of these latter family groups may quite possibly have antedated Toronto somewhat. In any case, it is sure that Anne, Lois, and Katie long ago planted the ideas which have since flowered into hundreds of Al-Anon family groups, one of the most encouraging developments in the whole AA picture in recent years. Another early AA traveler was Archie T. He had been tenderly nursed back to sobriety in the home of Dr. Bob and Ann at Akron. Still sick, frail, and frightened, he returned to his native city, Detroit, the scene of his downfall, where his personal reputation and financial credit still stood at zero. We saw Archie make amends everywhere he could. We saw him delivering dry cleaning out of a broken-down jalopy to the back doors of his one-time fashionable friends in Grosse Pointe. We saw him, helped by a dedicated non-alcoholic, Sarah Klein, start a group that met in her basement. Archie and Sarah next straightened out a man named Mike, a manufacturer, and a socialite lady named Ann Kay. These were the ones from whom stemmed Detroit's huge membership of later years. Then there was Larry J., a newspaper man who had barely escaped death by DTs and exhaustion. Despite a lung ailment that required him to spend much time in an oxygen tent, he courageously set out from Cleveland to Houston, Texas, and on the train, he experienced a spiritual awakening that made him feel, as he said, all in one piece again. On his arrival in Houston, Larry wrote a series of pieces for the Houston Press that attracted the attention of the townsmen and their Bishop Quinn, and thus finally, after heartbreaking setbacks, the first group in Texas emerged. Larry's first good prospects were salesman Ed, who was to carry the message to Austin, Army Sergeant Roy, who made the start at Tampa, Florida, and who later helped greatly in Los Angeles, and one Esther, who presently moved to Dallas, where, with characteristic enthusiasm and energy, she founded AA in that town and became dean of all the Alki ladies in the astonishing state of Texas. Meanwhile, Cleveland AA had sobered up Raleigh H., a famous athlete. Newspaper stories about this event were sensational, and they brought in many new prospects. Nevertheless, this development was one of the first to arouse deep concern about our personal anonymity at the top public level. Still another famous early itinerant was Irwin M., a Cleveland AA who had become a champion salesman of Venetian blinds to department stores in the Deep South. He used to range a territory bounded by Atlanta and Jacksonville on one side and Indianapolis, Birmingham, and New Orleans on the other. Irwin weighed 250 pounds and was full of energy and gusto. The prospect of Irwin as a missionary scared us rather badly. At the New York headquarters, we had on file a long list of topers in many a southern city and town, people who had not been personally visited. Irwin had long since broken all the rules of caution and discreet approach to newcomers, so it was with reluctance that we gave him the list. Then we waited, but not for long. Irwin ran them down every single one with his home-crashing tornado technique. Day and night, besides, he wrote letters to his prospects and got them to writing each other. Stunned but happy Southerners began to send their thanks to headquarters. As Irwin himself reported, many a first family of the South had been an easy pushover. He had cracked the territory wide open and had started or stimulated many an original group. Still thinking of the South, we remembered the Richmond AAs who believed in getting away from wives and drinking only beer, but who became more orthodox through the ministrations of the Virginia Squire, Jack W., and certain AA travelers. We thought, too, of the Jersey boiler inspector, the tireless Dave R., who had descended upon Charlotte, North Carolina, and of Fred K., another Jersey man, who set the AA ferment going in Miami, and of super promoter Bruce H., who, working in Jacksonville and its environs, was the first to use radio to carry the message. Shortly after the beginning of AA in Atlanta, that shaky group was sparked by the appearance of Sam, a high-powered Yankee preacher, temporarily minus frock and salary. Sam spoke with great effect from both pulpit and AA platform. He created a sort of Chautauqua brand of AA, which was mildly deprecated by some members, but cheered on by others. Sam has since passed away, but his work is remembered gratefully. Many more of these early people and early stories came flooding back to mind as we in St. Louis continued to review the history of AA's growth. We remembered the excitement of the formation of the first AA group solely by mail in Little Rock, Arkansas, the first Canadian group in Toronto, and soon after those in Windsor and Vancouver, B.C., the first beginning in Australia and Hawaii, creating a pattern later followed in some 70 foreign lands and U.S. possessions. The affecting tale of the little Norwegian from Greenwich, Connecticut, who had sold all he had to go to Oslo to help his brother and thus started the group there. The Alaskan group that had taken shape because a prospector out in the wilds found an AA book in an old oil drum. the Utah alkies who dried up in AA and struck uranium in the process. The spread of AA to South Africa, Mexico, Puerto Rico, South America, England, Scotland, Ireland, France, and Holland, and then to Japan and even Greenland and Iceland. The story of Captain Jack in a Standard Oil tanker spreading AA as he sailed. In such happy reminiscences, we at St. Louis reviewed AA's crossing of the barriers of distance, race, creed, and tongue, and saw our fellowship reaching to the four corners of the earth. These tales brought Lois and me wonderful recollections of our 6 weeks' journey abroad in 1950. We could remember the heated arguments between the Swedes of Stockholm and the Swedes of Göteborg over whether AA should be based on Stockholm's seven steps or America's 12. We recall meeting the founder of the wonderful group in Helsinki, Finland. We could still see the Danes at Copenhagen as their ringy ring wondered whether AA or antabuse was their answer. We remembered Hank Crowville, in whose home we were guests while in Holland. Hank, a social worker and non-alcoholic, was engaged by the city of Amsterdam to see what he could do for the drunks there. He had been able to do very little until one day he ran across AA's 12 steps. Translating them into Dutch, he handed them to some of his charges. To his astonishment, several tough cases went dry. And by the time we arrived, he could show us plenty more. AA was solid in the Netherlands and well on its way. Our great friend Henk Crowville has since become one of Europe's leading authorities on the total alcohol problem. In Paris, we found several scattered American AAs who acted mostly as a reception committee for AA travelers, some dry and some in deep trouble. The Frenchmen at Paris were still pretty shy about AA, and they were possessed of the wonderful rationalization that wine was not liquor at all and was therefore quite harmless. In London and Liverpool, we met many very anonymous Englishmen. In those days, their meetings had a definite parliamentary atmosphere, including a gavel which was struck at appropriate moments. Of course, the Irish AA was everything we expected and more. The South of Ireland AAs at Dublin were on the most genial basis with the North Islanders at Belfast, despite an occasional burst of rock throwing among their compatriots in the streets. We watched as the seeds of AA pushed up their sprouts in Scotland, and when we encountered Scottish hospitality, we knew for sure that the Scotsman AA is neither penurious nor dour. To Lois and me, this overseas experience was like turning the clock back to early times at home. Depending on their stage of progress, the foreign groups of that day were either flying blind, were hopefully pioneering, or had reached the fearsome and sometimes quarrelsome state of adolescence. They were reenacting all of our American experiences of 15, 10, and 5 years before. We returned home with the sure conviction that nothing could stop their progress, that they could surmount all barriers of social caste or language. In the 7 years since our 1950 visit, the AA achievement overseas has far exceeded our highest hopes. I have saved our Norwegian impression for the final part of this foreign account, because the story of the beginning there is a classic. It all started in Greenwich, Connecticut, in a coffee shop owned by a quiet little Norwegian and his devoted wife. The Greenwich group had lifted him to sobriety, and his shop had become a popular rendezvous for them. The little Norwegian had not written and had not heard from home. In the 20 years, he had been a virtual derelict. But now, feeling sure of himself, he sent a letter bringing the folks back there up to date and telling them all about himself and his escape from alcoholic oblivion via AA. He soon received an excited and pleading letter telling him of the awful plight of his brother, a typesetter on an Oslo newspaper. The brother, his relative said, was not long for his job and maybe not long for this world. What could be done? The little Norwegian in Greenwich took counsel with his wife. They sold their coffee shop, all they had in the world, and bought a round trip to Oslo with only a little to spare. A few days later, they saw their homeland. From the airfield, they hurried down the east bank of Oslo Fjord to the stricken brother's house. It was just as they had been told. The brother was close to the jumping-off place. But brother was obstinate. The man from Greenwich told his AA story and retold it. He translated the 12 steps of AA and a small pamphlet he had brought along. But it was no use. Brother would have none of it. Said the travelers, "Have we come all the way to Oslo just for this? Our money will soon run out, and we shall have to go back." Brother said nothing. So the Norwegian from Greenwich began to canvass the clergymen and some of the doctors in Oslo. They were polite, but not interested. Much cast down, the AA and his wife made their plans to return to America. Then the impossible happened. Brother suddenly called out and said, "Tell me more about those anonymous alcoholics in America. Explain again their 12 steps to me." He sobered up almost at once and was able to watch his brother's plane take to the air for New York. He had got the message all right, but he was alone now. What could he do? The instant he got back to work, he started modest ads in his own newspaper, one every day for a month. Nothing happened until the very last day. Then the wife of one of Oslo's sidewalk florists wrote him a letter asking help for her husband. When the florist heard the story and studied the 12 steps, he too dried up. The two-man group continued the newspaper notices that AA had come to town. Soon they had a third sober member. Among others who followed was a patient of Dr. Gordon Johnson's, Oslo's leading psychiatrist. Dr. Johnson, a deeply religious man, at once saw the implications of AA's 12 steps and immediately threw the whole weight of his reputation behind the uncertain little group. 3 years later, Lois and I looked through the customs gate at Oslo Airport upon a large welcoming delegation. Very few words of English could they speak, but they didn't have to. We could see and feel what they had. On the way to the hotel, we learned that Norway already had hundreds of AAs now spread into many groups. It was unbelievable, yet there they were. What happened to the little Norwegian from Greenwich? He came home and somehow started another coffee shop. 4 years later, he suffered a heart attack and died, but not before he had seen AA grow great in Norway. One more word about Norway. Quite unknown to the rest of that country, a group had sprung up in Bergen at about the same time that Oslo got underway. Hans H., a Scandinavian-American, had returned to his hometown with an AA book. Having perfect command of English, he could translate it into Norwegian as he read aloud to a tiny band of alcoholics that he had somehow gathered about him. With the benefit of this auspicious beginning, several laid hold of sobriety and thereafter spread the message in this city to such good effect that Bergen today can point to 16 AA groups as the remarkable result. At many another convention meeting, the panorama of AA in action today was unfolded. AA clubs, now numbered by the hundreds, had their problems aired and their assets and liabilities weighed. There was a lively swapping of experience on how best we could give brother and sister sufferers in mental hospitals and prisons a still better break while they were in these places and when they left them. Great numbers of these folks were already making good and had become our fast friends and co-workers on the outside, and we realized how foolish had been our early fears of the alcoholic bearing a double stigma. In still another seminar, secretaries and committee men of scores of local central services, the so-called intergroup associations, exposed their many problems for each other's inspection and advice, always seeking to remedy the functional weaknesses of the many newer service bodies just trying to get underway. In another meeting, the whole subject of money in AA got a most healthy kicking around. AA's principle of no compulsory fees or dues can be construed and rationalized into no voluntary group or individual responsibility at all. And this fallacy was exploded with a bang. There was complete unanimity that through voluntary contributions, the legitimate bills of groups, areas, and AA as a whole must be paid, or we could not properly carry our message. It was agreed that no AA treasury ought to get overstuffed or rich. Nevertheless, it was emphasized that the notion of keeping AA simple and spiritual by eliminating vital services that happened to cost a little time, trouble, and money was risky and absurd. It was the opinion of the meeting that oversimplification, which might lead us to muff our 12-step work, area-wide and worldwide, could not be called either really simple or really spiritual. Then there was a very moving get-together of lone AA members who had come in from the far reaches and isolated outposts to share the unusual view of our fellowship that St. Louis afforded. To no others could the convention mean so much. They got a fresh sense of belonging, and they realized that their isolation was never so complete as they had sometimes felt it to be. They knew, as few did, how greatly AA's literature and world services could help, for their sobriety had depended heavily upon the big book and upon those constant letters that came to them from headquarters and fellow loners. They had developed all sorts of gimmicks and disciplines to bulwark themselves and to perfect their conscious contact with God, who, they had joyfully discovered, could just as well be felt and heard whether one dwelt in a ship crossing the equator or next door to the polar ice cap. Typical of the loner's stories was that of the Australian sheepman who lived 2,000 miles from the nearest town, where yearly he sold his wool. In order to be paid the best prices, he had to go to town during a certain month. But when he heard that a big regional AA meeting was to be held at a later date, when wool prices would have fallen, he had gladly taken a heavy money loss in order to make his journey then. That's how much an AA meeting could mean to him. This was something that every loner at St. Louis could well understand. At another interesting gathering, the founders of many groups assembled to swap information on how best to get going in a new locality, since more than 7,000 AA groups, with a total membership of over 200,000, had already been spawned over the years, and new ones were taking shape somewhere in the world almost every day, there were plenty of experiences to share. A footnote informs that as of 1984, there are more than 58,500 groups worldwide and an estimated total of over 1 million members. In still another section of the convention, there was much to be learned about AA's Grapevine, our magazine of more than 40,000 monthly circulation and our biggest and best means of communicating current AA thought and experience in staying sober, in hanging together, and in serving. A footnote here says the circulation in 1984 is over 125,000. Among members of the Grapevine staff on hand were Editor Don, 3 editorial assistants, a photographer, and a number of artists and magazine experts. By talks and exhibits, they showed how the Grapevine's well-illustrated pages could be a lively and convincing means of introducing AA to the new or potential member, and how its articles could provide solid material for closed meetings and discussion. The Grapevine was seen as the monthly mirror of AA in action, always the same principle, yet ever growing and ever finding better ways of doing and thinking on new fronts of our exciting adventure in living and working together. Then there was a session called Presenting the Headquarters Staff. The staff was headed by manager Hank G., and it included fellow workers with talents in finance, public relations, and the like, and 5 capable AA women staff members. There was an extensive set of exhibits showing the wide range of activities of our top services. To the onlookers, the world headquarters of Alcoholics Anonymous was no longer the source of dry statistics about tons of literature, thousands of calls for help and letters in reply, and hundreds of problems of groups and of public information, or just the source of pleas for voluntary contributions. Here were the flesh and blood folks who were actually doing these things, and a well-trained, eager, and dedicated group they were, just like the Grapevine Gang. Countless AAs at the convention got to know our trustees, those faithful alcoholic and non-alcoholic friends who had served us so long. Many a grassrooter talked with Archie Roosevelt and learned that this exuberant and genial man had recently joined the board and had taken on the sometimes thankless and always time-consuming job of being its treasurer. Grassrooters and city people alike began to say, well, if our new non-alcoholic friend Archie can spend years looking after AA's general finances, then we guess that we can certainly spare the minute it takes twice yearly to reach into our pockets for those $2 that Archie needs to balance AA's budget. Right up front among the biggest eye-openers of the convention were Al-Anon family group meetings, which bore the titles Meet the Staff, The Children of Alcoholics, Adjustment Between Husbands and Wives, and The 12 Steps. In St. Louis, many a skeptical AA had his first look at this movement within a movement and learned with astonishment that the family groups had jumped from 70 to 700 in only 3 years, and that right now a brand new one was popping up in the world about every day. Lois and speakers from many areas told us that the family groups had a world clearinghouse much like AA's headquarters, and that already there was literature, the beginning of a magazine, and even a new book. Many AAs had wondered what these family groups were all about. Were they gossip clubs, commiseration societies? Were they coffee and cake auxiliaries? Did they divert AA from its single purpose of sobriety? The family group meetings provided the answers. These new groups were not also RANs to AA, nor were they gossip factories. The families of alcoholics, wives, husbands, mothers, fathers, and children, were pointing AA's principles right straight at themselves and at nobody else. The family group speakers asked and answered plenty of questions like these. Weren't we just as powerless over alcohol as the alcoholics themselves? Sure we were. And when we found that out, weren't we often filled with just as much bitterness and self-pity as the alcoholic ever had been? Yes, that was sometimes a fact. After the first tremendous relief and happiness which resulted when AA came along, hadn't we often slipped back into secret and deep hurt that AA had done the job and we hadn't? For many of us, that was certainly so. Not realizing that alcoholism is an illness, hadn't we taken sides with the kids against the drinking member? Yes, we had often done that, to their damage. No wonder, then, that when sobriety came, the emotional benders in our homes often went right on and sometimes got worse. As the AAs listened, the family group speakers continued. Could we find an answer for all of this? At first, no. The AA meeting sometimes helped us, but not enough. We got a better understanding of the alcoholic problem, but not enough of our own condition. We thought AA's 12 steps were wonderful for alcoholics, but didn't think we had to take them too seriously. After all, we had been doing our best. There was nothing much wrong with us. So we reasoned, and so we complained when things continued to go badly at home. Or often, if things went well, we turned complacent, or maybe rather jealous of all the time our partners thought they had to spend on AA. But when the family groups were formed, these notions and attitudes began to change, and the change was mainly in us. The transformation really set in when we began to practice AA's 12 steps in daily living, in all our affairs, and in the company of those who were able to understand our problems as no alcoholic partner could. In the family groups, we see men and women, even those with active alcoholics on their hands, shake off their miseries and begin to live serenely, without blame or recrimination. We have seen many a partner whose mate was sober in AA, but still hard to live with, completely alter his or her thinking. Finally, we have seen badly bent children straighten around and begin to respect and love their parents once more. We have seen many kinds of pride and fear and domination and nagging and maddening possessiveness just melted away by the 12 steps as we practice them in the home. Like our AA partners, we family groupers are now getting the tremendous dividend which comes from the practice of step 12, carrying the message. And the message of our family group is this. You can have more than alcoholic sobriety in your own family. You can have emotional sobriety, too. Even if the rest of the family about you hasn't yet found stability, you can still have yours. And your own emotional sobriety often can hasten the happy day of change for them. Many an AA member who saw the family groups in action in St. Louis said afterwards, "This is one of the best things that has happened since AA began." When they saw the convention's press room, many visitors realized for the first time that good communications within and without were the actual arteries in which AA's life-giving blood circulates among us, and thence out to brother and sister sufferers everywhere. Something more than slow word-of-mouth message-carrying obviously has been required. Certainly not much 12-step work ever could have been done until the sick ones and their families had been reached and persuaded that AA might offer hope for them. This kind of communication often required the goodwill of clergymen, doctors, employers, and friends. Indeed, the goodwill of the public at large. For years, AA's headquarters had used every possible means of enlisting such goodwill. And in addition to our own efforts, our friends of the press, newspapers, magazines, and later radio and television had told our story faithfully and often, and had reported eventful AA occasions whenever they occurred. Thus, they had drawn thousands of alcoholics into our membership and were still doing so. They had not done this, of course, without help from us. Years ago, we found that accurate and effective publicity about AA simply does not manufacture itself. Our overall public relations couldn't be left entirely to chance encounters between reporters and AA members, who might or might not be well informed about our fellowship as a whole. This kind of unorganized simplicity often garbled the true story of AA and kept people away from us. A badly slanted press could prolong preventable suffering and even result in unnecessary deaths.